This is John Reese of BluePower.com. We're talking to Mr. Dave Schools, an amazing bass player, a wonderful human being, and a yurt.
That's not fair to call me a yurt. I've never been in a yurt in my life. I, however, have been in a yurt.
I have been in a yurt.
And I don't want to go back.
Come to find out last night that I, too, have been in a yurt.
That's right.
And didn't know that it was called a yurt. It was called something Chinese when I was in it. I don't remember what it was, but this is BluePower.com, and we're going through Mr. Dave School's life with the blues and the music that he loved and the influences, and we're plowed. We're plowed. I could be very plowed.
This is going to be a great show, folks. Keep it tuned in.
Absolutely, and I'm not even stoned. I can't believe it. But we're proud to have Mr. Schools here tonight and talking with us and playing some music that he likes personally that's close to the blues. There's a lot of blues here.
There's some blues, and believe me, everything that we're playing was influenced by the blues. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you.
We'd be talking about this stuff anyway, so we might as well make a show out of it.
Well, now we're going to go into the college years.
That's right. I'm 18 years old. I have finally packed my bags and left Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah.
With a tie-dyed T-shirt on to attend journalism school at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. Unbeknownst to me, a music mecca.
Yes.
Bands like the B-52s and REM were putting that town on the map.
Yeah.
The year was 1983. And I remember gleefully filling out my dorm room application where it said likes. I put Grateful Dead. And I know that somewhere in some room was some person sorting names and deciding who was going to be with who in what room. And they saw my Grateful Dead like, and then they found someone who had Grateful Dead as a dislike. And they put us together in the same room.
Oh, my God. How did that work out?
It didn't work out well. We hated each other's music, and I did it on principle just because he tried to neutralize all the Grateful Dead bootlegs I played with as much Sex Pistols and punk rock as he could find, which I actually liked, believe it or not, but there was no way I was going to let him know. But there was one thing we agreed upon, and it was the blues. Blues seems to transcend all of everything, disagreements and emotions, and one of the very first things that came to the University of Georgia in 1983 was this cat who had just put out a record called Texas Flood named Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Oh, yeah.
And my roommate Tom Leach and myself decided that maybe we should go see the show together. We had had some success going to see that David Lynch movie Eraserhead at the midnight movie. And we knew that there was some common ground in there. So we went down to the Tate Center, which is the University of Georgia's sort of cafeteria, entertainment, video game plex. And we saw Stevie Ray Vaughan perform with Double Trouble in a room that probably held 200 people.
Excellent.
And another life-changing experience.
Yeah.
I loved Jimi Hendrix. He really floated my boat when I was a kid. And maybe this was as close as I would ever get to seeing someone who could perform with that kind of pyrotechnic finesse, a showman, a loud rock and roll, a guitar hero experience. Stevie Ray Vaughan did it for us, and we talked about it, and we had plenty more fights. I remember hiding his alarm clock in the bottom of the trash can one morning. He had it set for 6 a.m., and it went off, and he couldn't find it. But we don't see each other that much, but you know, we were bonded by the blues. And I love this track. This is from the Live Alive record. It's Stevie Ray Vaughan doing I'm Leaving You Woman Before I Commit Some Kind of Crime. I don't know who wrote it. Do you know who wrote this originally?
No, I really don't.
But it's badass. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear him starting to quote Smokestack Lightning at the end of it after he's pretty much twisted the guitar into a pretzel shape.
Let's play it right now.
Let's hear it.
Mr. Stevie Ray Vaughan. Guess you can tell the audience was having a good time there.
Man, I would have loved to have seen that.
That was,
you know,
something.
The great thing about Stevie Ray was that he came back to the University of Georgia maybe 2 or 3 years later to play at the big giant Coliseum, which is unilaterally believed among all performing musicians to be the worst-sounding venue in the entire world. And it was one of these $2 for students type shows, and $15 or $20 for non-students. I wasn't a student anymore, and things had kind of moved on, even though Stevie was just about to break huge. He hadn't yet. And it was one of those, also one of those rare nights where it was snowing in Georgia.
And that is rare.
Having sold only maybe 200 tickets in a 10,000-seat arena, they finally decided to knock all the tickets down to the student price. And maybe they sold another 200, but I was one of the people who bought one. So there's 400 people in there, and Stevie Ray comes out and just says, "You know what? I've played to a lot less people, and I think everyone should just come on down to the front of the stage here, and we're going to have ourselves a really good time." It was one of the best performances I had ever seen. He literally dragged the guitar across the stage for a solo. I think he was doing Third Stone from the Sun.
Man.
And that was the last time I saw him. And it was unfortunate because it was probably only about 3 more years before he passed away.
I saw him at the Greek Theater here with a friend of mine named Evan Braun. Took me to see Stevie at the Greek. And just at the end of the set, he brought out Mitch Mitchell. And they played Red House. And it was amazing. It was really amazing. He was truly one of the phenomenal guitarists, and one of the classifications I have for guitarists or any musician is if I put 1,000 up and he was playing, I could pick him out.
Right.
Because he is so unique, his style is so unique, that you can pick Stevie out of 1,000 guitar players. And he was just phenomenal that night, and it was about 6 months later that he died.
It's such a shame. It's such a shame. But the legend grows.
Absolutely.
The legend grows. And I agree, as a soloist, he was one of those rare people that it was like just turning on a spigot.
Yeah.
When he'd start playing, the spigot was on.
Yeah.
And it was going to flow until he turned it off.
Yep.
Never ran out of places to go. Always intense. Always with the right feeling.
Sense of dynamics was amazing.
Unbelievable. And just sounded like sometimes a chicken with its neck getting wrung. I loved it.
Well, I tell you, Stevie Ray Vaughan was certainly a phenomenon. And I would like to know if someone ever recorded any of the gigs, his Texas gigs, in the early days. I have never seen any product from, like, some smoky little club down in, you know, in Austin. For instance, and 150 people in there, you know, where he played night after night after night. I mean, one-nighters and just joints, because I'm sure that's where he honed his skills.
Absolutely. Certainly there are people out there. I know that product continues to march out to the shelves.
Yeah.
There's a DVD that has 2 performances from the Montreux Jazz Festival.
Oh.
One being his debut there where he was booed.
Oh.
And it makes no bones about it in the liner notes, because the second one, he comes back and returns triumphant and is understood by the audience at Montreux. And you know, maybe that speaks volumes in and of itself.
Absolutely.
But I can guarantee you that there's no end to the product that's going to be released on this cat.
Well, I'll be happy to get it. So what you got next on the list, son?
Well, it was about this time that we met. We had started Widespread Panic, and we were playing bars in the region. We'd go to Atlanta, we'd go to Macon. We met Phil Walden from Capricorn Records, who told us it was a big country and we weren't quite ready to be signed to his label yet. Well, of course, we would be in about 2 years. But we also met Michael Rothschild, who started the great independent label out of Atlanta called Landslide Records. And it was actually the great blues guitar player Tinsley Ellis who introduced us to Michael. Tinsley's band, the Hard Fixers, was recording on Landslide Records, and at his insistence, Rothschild came down to see Panic play. And it was at this point that Michael turned us on to some music he felt it was important that we hear as a band, a young band. And this included things like The Meters, But it also included Robert Johnson, Hound Dog Taylor. It was as raw as it got.
Yeah.
I had never heard anything like it. I'd read about it. Really hard to find anything you could listen to.
Yeah.
But we were riding around the region in our van, and when it wasn't broken down and when the radio was working, we'd play these tapes that Michael Rothschild had given us. It was sort of homework. I think he had sort of a sly, manipulative reason. You know, he knew that this music was important, and he knew that we needed it to seep into our veins.
Yeah.
And that it would help us in the end. They're kind of rudiments.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not right that we missed out on them. But thankfully, Michael Rothschild was there to slip it to us, and we could listen to it. So let's listen to Robert Johnson doing Me and the Devil Blues, and let's follow it up with Reverend Gary Davis doing Death Don't Have No Mercy.
Oh, my goodness.
Let's get real here.
Coming up.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door, this morning, ooh, when you knocked upon my door, and I said, "Hello, Satan, I believe it's time to go." Me and the devil was walking side by side. Me and the devil, ooh, were walking side by side. And I'm going to be my woman until I get satisfied. She said, "You don't see why that you would dog me round. Babe, you know you ain't doing me right, don't you?" She said, "You don't see why, ooh, that you would dog me round. It must be that old evil spirit so deep down in the ground. Nobody on the highway side. Babe, I don't care where you bury my body when I'm dead and gone. You may bury my body, ooh, on the highway side. So my old evil spirit can catch a greyhound bus and ride.
Death don't have no mercy in this land. Death don't have no mercy in this land. You come to your house and it won't stay long. You look in the bed and somebody be gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Well, death will go in any family in this land. Death will go in every family in this land. Well, it'll come to your house and it won't stay long. Well, you look in the bed and one in the family will be gone. Death will go in any family in this land. Well, he never takes a vacation in this land. Well, old Death never take a vacation in this land. Well, he'll come to your house and he won't stay long. You look in the bed and your mother will be gone. Death never takes a vacation in this land. Talk. Standing and crying in this land. Well, death will leave you standing and crying in this land. Well, he'll come to your house and it won't stay long. You look in the bed and leave, somebody will be gone. Death will leave you standing and crying in this land. Death always in a hurry in this land. Oh, death always in a hurry in this land. Oh, and he'll come to your house and he won't stay long. You look in the bed and your mother will be gone. Death always in a hurry. Well, they won't give you time to get ready in this land. Well, they won't give you time to get ready in this land. Oh, well, they come to your house and it won't stay long. Well, you look in the bed and somebody'll be gone. Death won't give you time to get ready. Make your last talk. Talk to me then. Talk to me then.
Tuned in to BluePower.com with John Reese and me, Dave Schools. We're talking about my life and the blues and the way it influenced me. And you just heard the Reverend Gary Davis doing the great Death Don't Have No Mercy, which is a song that I learned because the Grateful Dead did it. And I don't want to wax on and on and on about the Grateful Dead, but they did so many covers and they mined so many styles of music that it was a great way for someone like myself to discover these real tunes. I heard their version of Death Don't Have No Mercy, and I was motivated to find the real one,
yeah,
the first one. I didn't know Buddy Holly wrote Not Fade Away. I thought the Grateful Dead did. And they ran the gamut from Johnny Cash, Big River, Big Railroad Blues, I Know You Rider, Elizabeth Cotton,
yeah,
Tim Rose, Morning Dew. All these tunes that were part of their set that they were sort of tipping their hat to their influences. And that's something that's important to me now. When Widespread Panic does a cover tune, it's because we like it, and also it's because it was kind of important to us. And maybe it helps explain a little bit of what we do and why we do things the way we do. So if we go off and do a 20-minute long version of Low Spark of High Heeled Boys, it's because it meant something to us,
yeah,
the Traffic version. And if we do Werewolves of London or Sin Lawyers, Guns and Money, it's because we loved Warren Zevon, and it's apropos for the night we play it.
Yeah.
You know, hey, maybe we got sued or something that day. Who knows? Or maybe we're just in a funny mood and we want to sing about werewolves eating Chinese food in the rain.
Absolutely.
Who knows?
It's Yvonne, an amazing cat. So now you're in college. And how many years did you go to college down in Athens?
I guess I made it 2.5.
Yeah.
I desperately tried. I switched from journalism to English. And then I switched from day school to night school, thinking foolishly that it would be easier to get up and go to class after a gig if I didn't have to get up at 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
But then I found out that the night school gigs were making me late to my band gigs. So it became obvious that if I wanted to try and play music, that was the time of life. I was 19 years old, 20 years old. That time of life comes around once.
Absolutely.
We got ourselves a van. We got signed to Landslide Records. We made a record called Space Wrangler.
Yeah, great record, too.
Thank you. And it's hard to believe it was almost 20 years ago we made that record. It frightens me. But we continued our musical education. We ran into a lot of people who dug deep.
Yeah.
And gave us things to listen to on the road. And we met a cat named Britt West, who was in a band called White Buffalo from Athens, Georgia. We did a lot of shows with them. Britt's still around tuning pianos for a living. And playing guitar, I can only assume. I'm so seldom home, but I miss people like him. But he dug deep, and he had some resources to get recordings. I guess maybe he hit the flea markets and the pawn shops and found scratchy old vinyl records. And he turned us on to Hound Dog Taylor, which was as raw, ragged, and ugly mean as it could get. And we just ate it up. We wanted to sound like that so bad, but there was no way we were gonna. But it seeped in again, you know, the sort of the visceral attitude, the sound, the sort of devil may care about aesthetics and technique.
Yeah.
And it's all about emotion. And it's all about sort of a fountainhead of feeling.
Yeah.
And you cannot help but be bowled over by something like Hound Dog Taylor when you hear it.
That's true. Absolutely true. So what do we got up next?
Well, we got Hound Dog Taylor doing Rock Me.
That's a very good cut.
Thank you.
Let's put that on right now.
Let's do it.
Mr. Hound Dog Taylor, Rock Me.
Rock me, baby.
Mr. Hound Dog Taylor, Rock Me Baby, Rock Me All Night Long. Now, that is an intense version.
It's great.
Yeah, it is. It's marvelous. That you listened to this is amazing to me, because I did not know that you had these blues roots. And I wish I had, you know, a long time ago.
Well, you know, it's not something that I generally put on the turntable.
Yeah.
But in preparing for this show, I started realizing that there are a lot of tentacles.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of seepage, and there's been a lot of influence wielded by the blues. It's the basis of everything we do.
Yeah.
You know, rock and roll, where would it be without the blues?
True.
It's like a starting point. It's a leaping off point. And the blues is never going to go out of style.
Never.
People are going to always do other people wrong.
Yeah.
There's always going to be cold-hearted women. There's always going to be drunken-hearted boys. The man is always going to stomp you down with his boot.
That's right.
And the blues is always going to make you feel better. And even though it doesn't make you feel better, it makes you feel like there's someone else out there that feels the same way.
Blues has a certain empathetic quality to it. The blues has always made me feel better. I always felt strange when I first heard the blues. I'm going, why is it called the blues? And I'm sitting here smiling.
I hear you.
You know what I mean? Joe Turner, Shirley and Lee, Let the Good Times Roll. I mean, it's just, there's so much great blues music out there that people today, young people, are just discovering. That's what's so great about the net, because everything old is new again.
Absolutely.
It's a marvelous thing. I want to ask you about your impressions of Phil Walden.
You know, right after he died, someone from Rolling Stone called and basically had the same question. You know, working with someone like Phil can be good and bad.
Yeah.
But rather than go over some of the things that obviously a powerful record person from the 70s would have done, it's just more interesting to call him sort of an undeniable groove detector.
Yeah, absolutely.
He could hear a piece of music or an artist play and know instantly whether it had any potential or whether it was bullshit.
Yeah.
A lot more can be said about Phil Walden. He was a riverboat gambler. I think one of his famous quotes was, well, we put a president in the White House and a record company out of business.
Yeah.
They were big supporters of Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign, and yes, it was also the sort of the end of cap music, single-handedly, Southern
really
rock.
Did.
I loved him. I thought he was great. We used to annoy him by saying, how come we never see you and James Brown in the same room at the same time, basically implying that they were the same person, just with different colors. meaning charisma out the wazoo.
Absolutely.
You know, Phil Walden's son, Phil Jr., was our first manager.
I didn't know that.
He found us playing a frat party at the Phi Delta Theta fraternity in Athens, probably in 1986, when we were doing about half of the material on Space Wrangler and the rest was covers.
Yeah.
Whatever we could cobble together to make an evening of music and make enough money to go get a Waffle House breakfast.
Waffle House.
Yellow food.
Absolutely. One at every stop along the freeway in Georgia.
Absolutely. That and a Stuckey's.
Absolutely. My wife, Lori, loves a Waffle House.
Who doesn't? Come
yeah.
on.
Yeah. I mean, you just go in there. It's always the same. Always tastes the same, no matter where you go.
When you live on the road, you aim for consistency.
Absolutely.
Because trying to shoot the moon with something delicious and good and healthy ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
But consistent mediocrity will get you through to the next day.
Well, I remember sitting in the, you know, talking about Phil Walden, Capricorn. I remember I was working for a gentleman named Joe Galkin, who was a major record promotion guy in the South, and a gentleman who took me in and trained me. And I remember being a fly on the wall when Joe and Phil were talking about Otis Redding and Volt Records, putting Volt Records together. I didn't know at that time what was going to happen, and I didn't know who Otis Redding was, but Joe Galkin believed so much in Otis Redding that he convinced Phil that he not only should sign the artist, but should start a record label. And Phil was saying, well, why don't we put him on Capricorn? Well, because he's close to another label called Stax, but we have the opportunity to do this and that, and we can start this label called Volt, and we can put Otis on it, and da-da-da-da-da, and the rest is history.
Absolutely.
And I was very, very pleased to be there. And Phil was always very nice to me. He was always very nice to me.
Congenial man.
Absolutely.
Always treated us great.
Yeah. No, it's... you had how many records out on Capricorn?
Well, probably maybe seven.
Yeah.
Maybe seven.
Very good records, too.
Absolutely.
Great stuff, and he allowed you to kind of stretch out, too.
Well, he let us do what we wanted to do because he knew from his experience that some artists require coddling,
yeah,
and guidance, and others respond better to just being left alone.
Yeah.
And he measured the times, which was the late 80s, early 90s, and that was a time to leave a large band of six people to their own devices.
Yeah.
It worked out well. Like Bill Graham bent over backwards to help us.
Yeah.
In our early days, and it pains me to not have those guys around just to sort of be able to talk to after 20 years in the business. When
yeah.
you're a wet-eared young man and you just play a festival in Telluride, Colorado at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and 5,000 people showed up in the rain to see you play for 40 minutes and you don't go over your allotted time.
Yeah.
We try to run off stage and Bill Graham is blocking our exit. And he says, where the hell do you guys think you're going? And we're like, well... You know, we're the first band for the things to stay on schedule. We need to get off stage. We're done. Our set is over. He goes, I think those people who stand in the rain want to hear an encore.
Uh-huh.
Get back out there and do one.
Graham was tough.
He was tough, but he liked us.
Excellent.
And there were a lot of those old school people that maybe caught a whiff of something that reminded them of why they loved being in the business.
Yeah.
No matter how badly the late 70s and 80s may have beat them up.
Yeah.
And it helped us out a lot. I loved it because I was a student of the history of rock and roll. And these were big leaders.
Absolutely. Bill Graham was the West Coast man for many years.
Between him and Peter Grant, even though they didn't really get along, they made it a touring band's world.
Yeah, absolutely.
You went out and toured not necessarily to sell records, but to make a living.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't forced to go out by your record company and advertise for your hit single.
Yeah.
You went out and you played your concert and you did what you did and people came to see it and it was an enjoyable experience.
Yes, absolutely. The Fillmore was one of my favorite places in the world.
Still there.
Yeah.
Different locations, still the Fillmore.
Still the Fillmore.
Mm-hmm.
They still have the stuff floating on the walls.
Well, they have great curtains, but they still have an amazing chandelier and quite a collection of posters.
The one thing I remember about the 60s the most are the great the venues, you know, like the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit and the Fillmore in San Francisco, the Kinetic Playground. I mean, there were just so many wonderful places to play, each one unique, and each one had its own feel and feeling. But let's get back to some music here. We could just talk all night about that.
But these people don't want to hear us talk. They want to hear us talk about the blues and then play some for them.
Absolutely.
Let's jump ahead to Widespread Panic is in a van doing well, spending about 250 days a year on the road. And we have a sound man that we affectionately refer to as Gomer.
Yeah.
Who, if he was here, you would need a translation. He don't like it. He couldn't understand a thing he said. But Gomer knew music. And Gomer knew the blues. And the one thing that I will always thank him for was turning me on to Freddie King.
Absolutely.
Because Freddie King, to me, espoused a sort of a guttural polish. You know, it was heavy and it was fat and cold and mean all at the same time. But there was some polish to it. The playing was beautiful. And these Leon Russell produced records with the horn sections and everything. It's just glossy, but it still retains what I like about the blues, which is sort of a guttural everyman feeling.
Yeah.
This tune just killed me when I heard it. It's Palace of the King, and it needs no explanation.
From the stumble to the palace of the king, Mr. That's right. Freddie King himself, an amazing blues man.
What a guitar tone. I believe Chuck Berry said it was like ringing a bell.
Yeah. Freddie King, the stumble, and what was the other one he had? He had another big, big hit. I can't think of it right now. I'm getting old. This is John Reese, by the way, at BluePower.com, and we're carrying on this evening with Mr. Dave Schools, the fabulous bass player of Widespread Panic, among other groups. Because I've seen you play with Government Mule, with Panic. Who else have you played with?
Played with Jay Mascus in the Fog.
Right.
Played with the Stockholm Syndrome.
Yep.
I play very frequently with Jerry Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I love to play.
Yeah. It's obvious. When you play, watching you play, it's very obvious that you love to play.
Well, thank you. I've had good training, and I've had great influences, and I've been lucky enough to find people who love to play as much as I do.
Yeah.
To play with. There's never been any bullshit.
Yeah.
With any of the guys I play with. Everybody's crazy in their own way, but when it's showtime and you walk on stage, you play.
Yeah. I love watching you play with Jerry Joseph.
He's an intense little fella, isn't he?
Yes, he has come out with no shoes on, man. Just roars.
He does roar.
Yeah.
He has a lot to say.
Absolutely.
Probably one of the best songwriters in the present day that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
And hopefully someday that can change.
We'll change it.
We'll do what we can.
What's next on your list?
Well, I was thinking to continue along with the way things were going. Just more real blues learning.
Okay.
This song in particular, this Death Letter Blues, is a song that our drummer Todd Nance and myself we'd sort of sit around and we'd listen to these old blues tunes and we'd try to find the one that was the most hurtful.
Yeah.
Or the saddest, you know. What is the saddest blues of all time? What's the one that really chisels your heart with an ice pick of sadness?
Yeah.
And we both finally came to the conclusion that it's Son House doing Death Letter. I don't think there's anything that just sums up the sadness and the reality of the passing of a loved one more than this tune. You know, you can listen to Lead Belly, but it's more hateful and mean.
Yeah.
Then this is just blue. I mean, this is a soul who has lost his loved one, and he put it in a song. So this takes the cake for me. Get out your hankies.
Death Letter Blues.
Son House.
Son House.
Right here on Blue Power.
I got a letter this morning, I do. You rang it red. He said, honey, gal, your love is dead. I got a letter this morning. How do you ring it red? You just said, hurry, hurry. I call it, gal, your love is dead. Oh, I grabbed up my suitcase, took her down the road. When I got there, she's laying on a cooling board. I grabbed up my suitcase and I said, I took her down the road. I said, but when I got there, she was laying on a cooling board. Well, I walked up right close, looked down in her face. Said, good old gal, gonna be here the judgment day. I walked up right close and I said, I looked down in her face. I said, the good old girl gonna lay in a judgment day. The back of those 10,000 people standing round the burying ground. I didn't know I loved her. Tell her, let her down. Looked like 10,000 was standing round the burying ground. You know I didn't love her. Tell her again, let her down. Well, I fooled up, Mom. I slowly walked away. I say, farewell, honey. I'll see you judgment day. Yeah. Oh, yes, I walked away. I say, farewell, farewell.
the good old sun went down, I didn't have a soul to throw my arms around. I didn't feel so bad until the good old sun went down. To love someone don't love you, ain't satisfaction, don't care what you do. Yeah, it's so hard to love someone don't love you. You don't look like it ain't satisfaction, don't care what you do. Well, I got up this morning to break a day, just hugging the pillow. She used to lay, and I said, soon this morning, yes, it's a break of the day. You know I'd hug in the pillow, oh, how my good gal used to lay. I got up this morning feeling round for my shoe. You know I must have the walking blues. Soon this morning, feeling out from my shoes. Yeah, to know about that, I must have the walking blues. Oh, hush! Thought I heard her call my name. It wasn't so loud, so nice and plain.